Today's episode is being brought to you by Mott and Bow. They're jeans that look and feel good, premium denim, premium service, and they're only $100, not the crazy $200 jeans that all you guys are buying these days. Go to mottandbow.com and enter cracked at checkout for 15% off. This episode is also being brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. If you guys want a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter offer code cracked at checkout. Better web starts with your website. And welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and today we're talking about statistics that seem to disagree with reality. We've got these two main ways of making sense of the world that the SATs measure. I think the SATs got that right. You've got your descriptive language, and then you've got the numerical measurement, and the words kind of form the narrative, and we use that to make sense of the events in our life and construct sort of a comprehensive worldview. And then we usually just use the numbers to kind of fill in the gaps where the words don't go and don't seem specific enough. And that's how we like to think they work together, like two cognitive antennae keeping each other in check, telling us true things about the world. But today we're talking about glitches in the matrix that happen when they don't agree. For instance, a few months ago, I got on a scale and I was about 10 pounds heavier than I expected to be. The numerical measurement on the scale, totally out of line with the version of the universe I'd built out of words. I've been running a lot lately. I did that podcast a few months back where I talked about how bad processed food was. Some of that good advice I gave all you people must have stuck with me, right? That was the version of the universe I'd built out of words, and here was an objective numerical measurement that called bullshit. And I feel like culturally we have these sort of sticker shock moments with objective statistics pretty frequently. Some of our most popular nonfiction books are usually about this. Moneyball and the Statistical Revolution in Major League Baseball, Fooled by Randomness, which used statistics to make Wall Street traders look like the island tribe in Joe versus the Volcano, believing that the volcano hadn't erupted in a few generations because all those virgins and middle-aged Tom Hankses that they'd been feeding to it, when actually it's just a small sample size they're using and they actually have no effect. It's correlation causation. But it's hard to correct a good cultural misconception once it gets going. We don't even have to ignore them. We find ways to just sort of shift the narrative around them. Words are really flexible and, you know, we just kind of make room for them. Financial analysts create new rules to explain why the housing market crashed after they said it was going to keep going up. Baseball managers talk about how statistical nerds have no feel for the game. My initial hypothesis that my weight gain was caused by just how huge my penis had gotten recently was eventually toppled under the weight of, you know, a lot of photographic evidence stretching back to my first iPhone. And I realized that this is just what happens to your body when it's over 33 years old and you dump a couple beers into it every night. But I guess the thing I hadn't quite accounted for until researching this podcast is that these aren't really isolated instances. Our modern scientific objective world is still mostly these untested assumptions. And in fact, the more important the industry, the more likely it is to be completely full of shit. So that's what we're talking about today, the many ways we're learning that the antennae we rely on most, the language one, really good at lying to us, telling us sweet little lies. And I don't know why I quoted, who's that, Stevie Nicks? Anyways, and we've been relying on it far too much, the language one. We've built our entire realities out of words and descriptions, and these numerical measurements keep coming along and shattering them and revealing the universe we thought we were living inside of was just a fictional story we told ourselves. That's what we're going to be talking about. I will be back at the end for some footnotes. I want to change. right, we're talking about statistics today. I'm joined by Daniel O'Brien here in the office. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Jack. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for asking. Hey, and we're also joined by Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong, our executive editor, somewhere in the middle of America. How's it going, Jason?
It's going well. And yes, I'm joining by phone. We get continual complaints, people asking, what's wrong with Jason's microphone? It's a telephone.
Yeah,
we're
guys,
using an antiquated phone system that was installed in America in like the 1890s, and I'm sorry, the audio quality is just not the same.
I do want to be clear to our audience, Jason is in the office. He just refuses to be in the same room with us when we record this. He's just calling from his desk.
Again, the restraining order I have against Dan and all other members of the crack staff that do not allow them to make eye contact with me.
I prefer to start a rumor that your relationship with the podcast is like Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock's relationship in Lake House, and you are calling from the 1800s. It doesn't just sound like that. So your knowledge of our popular culture is impressive.
I like that Jack thinks the Keanu Reeves part of the Lake House took place in the 1800s.
We make really clever pop culture references to things we've not seen.
Just have a vague awareness of the log line. Could be totally off. They're ghosts that are total busters. And yeah, we're kind of like that. So I think everyone has heard the saying that statistics are like assholes. Everyone's got one, and they're way more flexible than people think, and better at hiding things than you expect, I think, is the way it goes, right? Jason, this was your suggestion for a subject, and it's like sort of a whole genre of things we've covered on the site. It's sort of a clash between the two ways that we make sense of the world, right? We've got descriptive language and then numerical measurement, and occasionally a numerical measurement or like a system of measuring the world and predicting the world will just come along and totally just shatter the reality that we thought we were living in and kind of reveal it to be just this big fictional story that we'd been telling ourselves.
It's like this for me, maybe more than most people, because math and numbers is the one subject, or rather one of several hundred subjects, that I just don't grasp, so it always sounds like sorcery to me. So when a really mind-blowing stat comes along, and we're going to go over a few of these where the statistic doesn't seem possible. Having lived your life, it's like there's no way this can be true, but no matter how many times you run the simulation, no matter what data you look at, it is. And I don't doubt there's people listening to this who aren't as amazed by numbers because they don't have my simple non-number brain, but I just find this stuff amazing because I suspect, like you just said, so much of the stories we tell ourselves about the world and about the culture are just wrong because we didn't evolve to understand complex numbers. We didn't evolve to understand things like probability and such.
When I was thinking about some of the statistics that have surprised me most, they've been around really important things like healthcare and crime, sort of these things that are extremely important, and therefore they kind of tie in our emotions. So it's almost like we are less likely to actually understand things the more important they are, because we're more likely to appeal to other people's emotions on those subjects and be like, well, you can't break this down to numbers. There are people's lives at stake here.
Right, and we have a forum thread discussing this exact thing, and it starts with Jason pointing out, here is some math that debunks the idea that a pitcher has any control over what a batter is going to do. Here it is in black and white or whatever colors we print numbers for all to see. And immediately the first person who responds is like, well, I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah, immediately disagrees. Yeah, so baseball, I guess, as we've done on another podcast, we're going to probably have to start with baseball because it might be the best example and probably the most well-known of what we're talking about. The movie Moneyball, I think people are generally pretty familiar with it. It's sort of the perfect storm of what we're talking about. That for a long time, baseball was this national obsession, and you know, some of the best journalism of the 20th century was written about baseball. Because it's based in sort of these heroic narratives, it almost seems like the more we cared about it, the more we created misconceptions. And it wasn't until recently that kind of science entered and was like, so the three main statistics that you care about in batting average, runs batted in, and home runs,
two of those don't matter at all.
It's only home runs, right? That's the only stat in all of baseball that matters?
It's not the only one, but it's the one that we didn't have wrong. Batting average was overrated because what they should have been measuring is the average number of times someone got on base. You know, if someone was good at walking or really good at jumping in front of the ball and getting hit by it.
Now, see, here again, Jack, walking gets you guaranteed first base. If you get a home run, that's all of the bases. That's every single one. Gonna go ahead and disagree again.
We shouldn't talk too much about detail because Dan clearly doesn't understand the rules of baseball.
I want to back up for a moment because I don't know if the listener is going to be clear why we're getting into baseball or getting into sports, period. The reason sports are great for this sort of thing is it's a really easy way to see how we get these things wrong elsewhere. The reason Moneyball, which is, if you just saw the ads, the Brad Pitt baseball movie, the reason that book is fascinating, the reason the movie is fascinating, it doesn't matter if you care about baseball or not. The point is that people who like baseball kind of invent stories for themselves about heroes and who the great players are and the heart of a champion and all this mythical stuff. And that finally, in the early 2000s, somebody started using computers and realized all of the mythology was wrong. You're worshiping the wrong guys because the guy looks so good. He's so big and strong in the way he swings the bat. He's exciting. And it knocked down a lot of that, saying, actually, these guys are grossly ineffective. The most effective players in baseball are these slow guys who just don't swing in a lot of pitches, and it's very boring and it's very tedious. But if you actually crunch the numbers, if you want to win baseball games, these boring, tedious guys who are just awful to watch, you can win a championship with a whole bunch of those guys. And it's become the microcosm for the way we think about the world, because there turns out there are lots of things like that. And so with sports, we tell ourselves all these stories about, you know what, this guy, he's just got some intangible it. And in reality, that's always a story we write for ourselves after the fact. And we'll say that a player is hot right now. He's got the hot hand, or he's really on fire. He's in the zone. And statistically, nope. That does not exist. If he is hitting above his normal average this month, he will simply hit below next month. He will revert to the mean. If you get a computer to just generate random numbers, hit, strikeout, walk, whatever, based on what this guy does, it will artificially generate hot streaks.
And this goes for all sports. If you've played basketball, if you've watched basketball, you think you've seen or been in the zone where, like, you hear people say, oh man, the hoop seemed like it was giant that day, or, you know, but statisticians say that there's no such thing as somebody who is a streak shooter.
Forgive me, because I know very little about both math and sports, but when people talk about a hot streak, that's different from someone just being a naturally good athlete, right? Like Calvin Johnson on my fantasy team regularly gets more points than all of the tiny humans running around him. That's nothing to do with streak. That's just he is
exactly
a very good player, right?
Yeah. Part of what this comes from is when I'm watching Calvin Johnson and tripping over myself as I go to the bathroom because I have a very serious cognitive disorder, I guess. I can't even make sense of his sort of athleticism. So when I see him do it twice in a row, I'm like, man, this guy must be in the zone. And it's just like, no, he's basically a robot compared to you. He's basically a superhero. And on average, over the course of a season, he has an 85% chance of, like, doing something spectacular when that ball is thrown in that position.
Correct. And the point is that if you have a guy who's a career 300 hitter, his strength, muscle memory, all those things have got him to hit the ball 30% of the time. If he has a period in a month where he suddenly is hitting 500, it's easy to say he's hot, he's on fire. Keep him in the lineup because he's on fire. He's got it going on. There's something, whatever he's doing different. And then what you find out is, actually, if he hit 500 that month, all that it means that there'll be some other month where he hits 150, and it will all come back to 300. This illusion of the streak, and if the sports thing is confusing you, you can apply it to anything. Picking stocks. People who manage these funds, professional stock pickers, they perform just slightly better than chance. Like, if you threw it at a dartboard, you'll match the performance of most funds. About 70% actually perform worse than just the Dow. I mean, if you just pick random Dow stocks, you outperform most funds. But yet, those guys will make huge money because they'll have a year where they nailed a bunch of underperforming stocks and they shot up and made a bunch of money. And so that guy now is a millionaire and getting paid. Bring your magic to us, your magic eye for stocks. In reality, he had no magic eye for stocks. If you had just generated a random list of wins and losers, if you just let the dartboard order to pick your stocks, you would have also had a year when you were hot. But in popular culture, we believe in the streak. We believe in being in the zone. A gambler at the roulette wheel wins three times and is like, I can't leave the table. I'm hot. I'm hot right now. It would be crazy for me to leave this good luck behind, when in reality, that luck doesn't exist. It's just you happen to be in the middle of a random streak of numbers, and because you're in the middle of it, you tell yourself the story, man, the hoop just looked like the size of a wading pool to me. You know, it came so easy. And it's like, yeah, but that's the story you told yourself after the ball went in.
It's easy to kind of see how that was useful at one time, right? Our brains were designed at a time when we were trying to learn lessons like, I saw fruit come off of that tree yesterday. I'm going to stand under that tree today. So it's basically like learning things with your eyes and assuming a pattern based on the things you're seeing with your eyes. This is also how the lottery works. One of the most annoying things statisticians say is it's statistically impossible for you to win the lottery. It's like, what the fuck does that even mean? It doesn't make sense to our brains how infinitesimal our chances of winning the lottery are, because we can see the people on TV winning the lottery. Our brains weren't designed in a world with national television where the one person who wins is broadcast out to millions of people. I watch a lot of lottery winning on TV.
I married Isis on the 5th day of May, but I could not hold on to her very long, so I cut off.
Hey guys, we want to say another thank you to this week's sponsor, Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. They did not help us build and design crack.com when we were first launching it, but we really could have used their help. It was an ordeal. Where were you then, Squarespace? Not invented yet. And anybody who's launching a new site, website, portfolio, online store today is extremely lucky. And if you're listening to this, you're extremely luckier, because you can get a free trial and 10% off by visiting squarespace.com and entering offer code CRACKED at checkout. It's simple, it's easy, and it'll allow you to build a website that is beautifully designed, and that's super important. A better web starts with your website.
I came to a high place of darkness and light. The abiding light ran through the center of town. I hitched up my pony to a post on the right. Went into a laundry to wash my clothes down.
Here's a non-lottery example of why this matters. Crime. If you see a crime on TV that is particularly scary or gruesome or brutal, if it's a young white girl being kidnapped and murdered in some horrible way, if it's a flash mob of like 100 inner city youths attacking an establishment, you will become very, very afraid of that crime and you will start taking precautions against it. Even though statistically that example might be a singular example. We had mentioned on a previous call that the year that the Columbine school shootings happened, that was like one of the record low years for school shootings. Because while that was occurring, most school shootings happen in inner city schools over drug deals or whatever, and a lot of anti-gun policies, a lot of other things had reduced those drastically. Yet, because that was such a spectacular event, everybody came away from that thinking, oh my God, I'm scared to send my kid to school tomorrow because there could be a shooting, completely ignoring how much higher the probability is that your kid could be injured on a piece of playground equipment or molested by a teacher or any of the much more common things that happen. And we had a whole article about there are more people killed by cows than are killed by sharks. More kids die drowning in swimming pools than get shot by guns. But only one of those sparks your imagination, and it makes you ignore probability completely. And the whole war on terror was a lot based on this. The amount we've spent versus the actual risk to citizens is astronomical compared to almost anything, heart disease, whatever, but those things are boring, and a terror attack is so spectacular that we ignore how unlikely and how rare it is.
It's easier to mislead people when it's something that is important to them, because you involve their emotions and you involve words, and it doesn't seem like numbers should matter there, and those tend to be the places where we're just completely off base.
Right, and it's because as soon as you see one terrorist attack, that's what constitutes a hot streak, to borrow that from basketball. When 9/11 happens, then it's suddenly, all right, the terrorists are really working right now. And then if someone tried to tell me, I mean, I lived in...
The ratings for 9/11 were
right.
incredible.
Well, I lived in New Jersey, that. And if someone tried to tell me, you know, you're much more likely to get killed by a cow this year than you are a terrorist, that seems so absurd to me. There's no way I would take that person seriously, no matter what stupid fancy pants math they showed me, because New Jersey is a train ride away from New York, and that's where the terrorists just went. Even though I was probably 25 minutes away from cows, there's the part of my brain that we all have, I guess, refuses to accept their math in that case. I still sort of refuse to accept it.
I think the statistic we used was you're more likely to die from fireworks. I just didn't want cows to get a bad name. They're just more likely to kill you than sharks. Sharks are one of my favorite examples, because the summer of 2001, before September 11th, and I think I've mentioned this before, but it was called the Summer of the Shark by Time Magazine, because there was one fatal shark attack, and then like another cute white girl had her like arm or leg bitten off by a shark. So like that was the thing that we were all afraid of, as those guys were like taking their how to fly a plane lessons.
Right, because the repetitions of seeing the story on the news counts as a new instance every time for somebody. Yeah. You just had to assume you hear about a school shooting and maybe you remember hearing about one 6 months ago, so you just assume that that's just the tip of the iceberg. There must be like hundreds more we haven't heard about.
Right, there's one shark attack, but I've heard about it 13 times on different channels, so it's an epidemic.
In our column about guns, about weird things about the gun debate that Jack and I co-wrote, there's this fear among gun owners. One of the main reasons they keep a gun in the house is because they're scared to death of a break-in, like a rapist tries to break into their house. They want to protect themselves. And the number of instances where like that successfully happened, any law enforcement person would tell you, if you're truly scared about safety in your home, A, make sure you've got great exterior lighting. B, make sure you've got good locks and you keep them locked. C, make sure there's not like a lot of great hiding places in your yard, like they love shrubs and that sort of thing. D, make sure you got a fire extinguisher in your house. Make sure that your smoke alarms all have batteries. Make sure somebody in the house knows the Heimlich maneuver. There are all these much more common and more boring ways to protect yourself that people are obsessed with the thing they've seen in a billion horror movies and action movies, which is a figure sneaking into your home in the dark of night looking to kill you or rape you. So they want to keep that shotgun under the bed, even though statistically the odds are really great you're accidentally going to shoot your own child or something, because you wake up in the middle of the night confused and you just shoot at something. And it's the same thing with like rape statistics. When we talk about the prevalence of rape, there are women that hear that and then translate that to, I should never walk down a dark alley alone because the streets are piling with rapists. But then you look further into it and realize, oh, wait, the majority of these people are raped by someone they know. Happens on a date, happens at a party. But for some reason, that doesn't hit as hard as the idea that just walking home from school or from work, you could be assaulted by a gang.
There's an industry that can use that fear, the idea of random, shadowy, stranger assailants who come after you. That danger, it's something that has happened. It does happen. It's just statistically unlikely. And whenever it happens, it gets broadcast everywhere by the local news, because that is good for the economy. People buy guns. And when it's someone who knows you at a party, that doesn't get as publicized, because it's a sad story that's also bad for business, you know?
Well, and it's
bad for beer sales.
That's why the women in that situation, it's hard to get anyone to listen to them. Because if you say I've been raped, people have this mental image of, oh, you were walking down an alley and a guy in a hoodie and sunglasses jumped out and grabbed you. It's like, well, no, it was a party with my boyfriend and his friends and we were all drunk. It's like, oh, okay, you were raped, quote unquote. It's like, well, no, that's most sexual assault right there. But because we focus on the more, I don't know, more Hollywood version of it. And I mentioned earlier, whenever there's a young toddler, a white female toddler that gets kidnapped or murdered and becomes a national story, like once a year we randomly decide to notice one of these crimes and go on and on about like stranger danger, like, see, your children are not safe from the roving packs of pedophiles out there. can't let them out of your sight, can't let them go to the playground alone, can't let them, you got to stay on top of them. But in reality, that type of crime, a total stranger abducting a random child and raping it or murdering her or him, is microscopic. It's incredibly rare. The type of assault that happened to children that's incredibly common, again, is the ones of people they know.
Right.
Babysitters, teachers, family members, you know, siblings. That's incredibly common. Those kids need help. Those kids need counseling, protection, all those things. But they don't get it because nobody makes a movie about that. The Hollywood version is there are roving packs of drug-addled, violent people. It's like The Purge. They're all roving the streets, lawless, working with impunity, and by God, you can't let your kid out of your sight. And that's not true. See, it's as safe to walk home from work or walk home from school for a little kid now as it was in 1950. Statistically, it is as safe or safer, as in the Andy Griffith days.
The idea of, like, a child being taken out of their bed in the middle of the night, snatched through an open window, that I feel like I've seen in like at least five movies or TV shows. There's a very famous example of that happening to Charles Lindbergh, to his child, at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think the reason that's so famous is because it was the fear that everybody secretly has in their mind, but that's how unlikely it is. It happened in 1932, and that's the big national scandal that we have. Just another example from our article, Jason, about guns is probably the most shocking statistic I found during the research for that article was how much more common suicide is than homicide. I think I would have guessed that murder is probably twice as common as suicide. And it's actually the reverse. There's two times as many suicides in America than there are homicides, but you never hear about the suicides because they're sad stories.
Yeah.
And you hear about pretty much every homicide because they're stories that get the blood up.
And we'll get more ratings on television because they can say that you should also be worried and you should look around and buy more guns.
That's the thing. I don't think anybody thinks of it in these terms. That if you're going to be murdered at the hands of a gun, if somebody's going to shoot you to death, by a 2-to-1 margin, it's more likely to be your own hand than all the rest of the world combined. The other 7 billion people are only half as likely to shoot you as you are to shoot you. Whenever someone has committed suicide, one of the big warning signs of suicide is simply the fact that they owned a gun, because gun owners are so much more successful at killing themselves than people try to swallow pills or do anything else. Christ, if you know somebody's suicidal, get the gun out of their house and you improve the odds of them surviving hugely.
When you hear people are more likely to die when they have a gun in the house, you picture, like Jason, you alluded to earlier, like them accidentally thinking their child who's playing a laser tag is actually a robber or some accident happening. But the reason it's statistically significantly more dangerous is because of this thing that I called in the article second degree suicide. Like, we have second-degree murder where someone, in a fit of passion, someone kills somebody they catch sleeping with their spouse or whatever. A statistic that kind of put this in context for me was of all the people who've been kind of pulled off the Golden Gate Bridge right as they were about to jump, 90% of them don't go on to do it because it's just a temporary decision. It's whatever the equivalent of finding someone sleeping with your spouse is, but something that like makes you mad at yourself and that you would have gotten over by the next day. And so having a gun in the house, when Jason says you're more likely to die at your own hands, we kind of think, well, not me because I'm happy, but there's just these peaks, these like spikes in emotion that happen to people. I think that's another statistical misconception, is that every suicide is like this troubled, long running, this person must have been troubled. How did I not see the sign? It can just be that the wrong situation, the wrong place at the wrong time. As you know, fantasy football is back, and DraftKings.com is not messing around. They were accused of messing around last season, not doing it this season. DraftKings.com is America's favorite one-week fantasy football site where you could win enormous cash prizes every week. You've already researched all the players for your season-long fantasy team, and maybe you're not super thrilled with how things ended up for you? Well, now you can turn that knowledge into instant cash at DraftKings.com. Last year, one player turned 11 bucks into 4 G's. Another won 100 grand, his first time ever playing. And another player won $1 million in one day just by playing fantasy football. So head over to DraftKings.com now, and if you enter promo code CRACKED, you'll be able to play free. And that's great because some of the people who play there become millionaires, as we mentioned. Enter CRACKED for free entry now at DraftKings.com. Hey guys, we've got a new sponsor this week, Time's Up by R&R Games, which has been called the funniest game ever invented and the best party game out there, according to the experts at Board Game Geek. It's like Celebrity Charades, but with a clever three-round twist. You play it in teams and use a 40-card deck of fame that you create that's used throughout the three rounds. You try to get your teammates to guess all 40 names in the deck. So round one, you say or do anything. Round two, you use just one word, sound, or charades are allowed. And round three, you act it out, but you can't talk at all. I played a very similar game with my family on vacation recently, and it really is one of those, you know, you see on the side of board games like ages 7 to 99. It really was fun for all generations. Time's Up will have you laughing until you cry, and crying until you laugh. Probably not the latter. Ages 10 and up, and retails for $29.99. Check it out at www.rnrgames.com. And use promo code CRACKED and get 20% off.
As you told me that one day we would meet up again, and things would be different the next time we would. If I only could I hang on and just be her friend. I still can't remember all the best things she said.
Do you guys want to talk about the Monty Hall problem? Because that's one of these statistical things that, like, still doesn't make sense. You can explain it to me 100 times and I still don't understand it.
There's actually a few of these. I don't know how many of them we're going to go through today, but they're kind of thought experiments that prove humans are not programmed to understand probability. Like, when you're faced with trying to figure out how likely or unlikely something is, your brain just freezes up. We did not evolve in any way to accurately judge what are truly the odds of me dying in this plane crash. What are truly the odds of me winning the lottery? What are truly the odds of somebody breaking into my house tonight? We just lump it all together as it could happen. So the Monty Hall problem, this is named after a now defunct game show from, I think, the 70s or 80s called Let's Make a Deal. The host was Monty Hall. That's why it's named after him. He was not a mathematician. He was just the cheesy host of this really bad game show. It was stupid. Don't go look it up. It's not worth it. But there was this really simple, dumb puzzle they would have people do where there are simply three doors. And you, the person from the audience, one of the doors had a prize behind it, like a car. The other two were failure doors. They would have some wacky non-prize behind them, usually a goat. I don't know why it was a goat. In some parts of the world, that would be a really valuable prize.
Yeah, exactly.
This show sounds amazing, by the way. If you pick the goat door, do you keep that goat?
Well, that's not clear. Like, it's I think it's the same thing like at the end of Jeopardy. If you finish in negative numbers, do you have to, like, pay them? Do you have to, like, write them a check for...
That would be awesome if Trebek's just out back waiting for you after the show.
Or at the end of Monty Hall, if you get the booby prize in the parking lot, like, no, this goat is legally yours now. You've got to get it in your car somehow. Anyways, the point being, it's a dumb puzzle. You have to pick one of the three doors. You're given no hints, nothing. So when we start with probability, they couldn't be simpler. You've got a 1 in 3 chance of winning. So you say, door number 3. Here's what happens next. Of the remaining two doors that you didn't pick, he will open one and it will be a goat door. If the car door was one of the other two, he doesn't show it to you. He shows you another of the doors you didn't pick and says, okay, we're going to eliminate this door because this one's a loser. There are now only two doors left. You now know for a fact cars behind one, goats behind another. Do you want to change your pick? It sounds like a completely nonsense offer. What's the point? You had a 1 in 3 chance. You picked one. Either the car is behind there or it's not. The car doesn't move. Him revealing the other unrelated door should have changed nothing about the situation. So that choice, you should always wave it off because, like, it doesn't matter. Either I picked right or I didn't. I had a 1 in 3 chance. I still have a 1 in 3
right.
chance.
Now it's a 1 in 2, right? There's two left. So
right, but yeah. your original choice, that's irrelevant,
right.
is the idea. So then the question is, the Monty Hall, are you better off just keeping your original pick or changing your pick, or does it not matter? And 99 out of 100 people will say, it doesn't make any difference. When you pick, either the car's banked or it's not. Nothing has changed.
I'm with the people who say, it shouldn't matter, but I know what this podcast is about, so I'm probably wrong.
Correct. If you change your pick, you've doubled your chances of winning. You
will win twice
as often. Even though you originally had a 1 in 3 chance, and even though nothing should have changed because you're not working off any different information about the door you picked, it shouldn't make any difference. In reality, it doubles your chances from 30% to 60% or whatever.
Okay, doubles your chances. But do we have the stats on this, the people who have actually changed their answer?
So the people who agree with Dan on this include people with PhDs.
Stephen Hawking.
People who have natural minds for mathematics. There's a section of Parade magazine called Ask Marilyn, where the most insufferable person in America with a high IQ answers questions and riddles and explains why everyone's stupid. No, she's actually not that bad. I don't know why I'm being mean to Marilyn. But anyways, this question came in like 1990, and she said, no, your chances are 2/3 if you change your pick, and 1/3 if you stick with the door you've already picked. And she got bombarded with letters from PhDs being like, how are you so stupid?
It's more than 1,000 PhDs wrote in.
Yeah.
They got tens of thousands of letters, more than 1,000 were PhDs in mathematics saying, this is impossible. This is sorcery. This is black magic.
And so the only real way to prove this is by doing computer simulations. When you do computer simulations, you run them 100 of these scenarios, it comes out to 2/3 of the time if you switch the pick, you win.
No, you don't need a computer simulation. You need 3 pieces of paper and a friend.
Right.
I encourage anyone listening to this, thinks we're confused, get 3 post-it notes, write prize underneath one of them, put them face down, let the friend pick, reveal one of the non-winners, let them either change your pick or keep it, and log the results. You will see. This is the only way people are convinced is when you actually do it.
Well, I choose to remain unconvinced, so I will never do that. I'm opting to not change the way that I think about things.
I was having a real difficult time with this last night. I read the whole Wikipedia page, and the only way it kind of, sort of, I like that's my standard for, I really did some serious research.
I was up all night reading a single page.
Reading the whole Wikipedia page. But the only thing that sort of made a dent into me understanding this was the explanation that, think of it, instead of being 3 doors, think of it being 1,000,000 doors, okay? And think of it from Monty Hall's perspective instead of you being the contestant. And it kind of gets a little bit clearer, right? So let's say there's a car behind 1 out of 1,000,000 doors. You pick door number 1 again because you're very lazy. Monty Hall then has to open all the doors that aren't the car. All the goat doors. So there's this statistical set.
And now that
set.
One looks very conspicuous.
Right.
Because it's the one he avoided opening.
So when you chose, you were picking 1 out of 1,000,000. When Monty Hall chose doors to open, he was picking all the doors that have goats behind them and could not open the one with a car behind it. Think about it like you're trying to hide this from the contestant, and you're obligated as Monty Hall to build suspense by like opening all the goat doors besides the one door that they picked. That makes it make more sense to me, because then you've got this one left that Monty Hall hasn't opened, and it's like, well, okay, I'll take 77, Monty
yeah.
Hall.
No, I stick with 1 because, like, oh my God, how amazing. What a hot streak I'm on.
This is what even the PhDs didn't get. Monty Hall is not picking randomly. He is picking with knowledge of where the car is and where the goat is. When he reveals the open door, he doesn't randomly reveal the car an accident. He always reveals one of the goat doors. So he is giving you new information about the one you picked. So that's the thing, because it actually does change now what you know about yours, which is you now know that the one you picked is one of these remaining 2, and it completely resets the game because the circumstances have completely changed. But if you're having trouble understanding this, just reminder, most really, really smart people cannot understand this.
Well, I get it now.
Do you?
I do. I think
yeah.
so.
Awesome.
My caveman brain has been stuck for all time on Chuck Klosterman's version of statistics, which is everything is a 50-50 chance. Oh, there's a drawer, and it's got 6 red marbles in it and 4 blue marbles in it. You reach in, what are the odds that you're going to pick a blue marble? 50-50. I will either pick it or I won't. And that has informed my brain on statistics.
That's what he says with, his
yes,
version of statistics.
That's all statistics for me, is that I think, this guy has hit 9 home runs the last 2 games. What are the odds that he's going to hit a home run now? 50-50. He's either gonna, because you don't think about when you're just, your choices are just, he's either going to do the thing or he's not going to do the thing. Everything becomes 50-50, which is simple for me because I never made it past second grade. So this is the amount of information I can handle.
He also had an interesting thing about statistics in football and the book Eating the Dinosaur, where he was talking about how football is kind of this really trendy thing. Like in the 80s, it was trendy to do hard-nosed rush up the middle football, and now it's really trendy to have quarterbacks and have sort of the air attack. And he pointed out that mathematicians will tell you that every football offense should go for it on fourth down every single time, which coaches get laughed at in the media if they go for it on fourth down. But there's this one high school football coach in Florida who had very little experience with football, but he was a math teacher and he figured this out and rode this statistical advantage to all sorts of wins. Maybe that's where we're headed, but that's another one of those things like the Monty Hall problem that just doesn't seem right to me. There's like something really intuitive to me about like, oh, you got to punt. You always got to protect yourself because punting's awesome.
Yeah.
It's the most fun thing to do.
But Jack, why do people punt? Explain for the listeners why punting is still a thing in the NFL and at the pro level. What lures them into doing it?
If you go for it on fourth down and like, all right, we're going to try another play here, that opens yourself up to getting an interception by the other team or an incomplete, and then the opposing team has a better field position than
right. You move the other team.
Probably.
The other team's offense takes over further back in the field. They have worse field position. It makes sense to me that it would be hard to change that strategy because the football coach has to make kind of a gutsy decision and they're going to be mocked for every time it fails.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Fear.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't matter how many times you show them the stats. Just as you could convince me that tarantulas are the safest animal to have sitting on your face. It is statistically safer to have a tarantula sitting on your face than a kitten. It is very difficult, no matter how many numbers you show me. So what happens is going for it on fourth down, even for people who aren't familiar with football, it's basically what's perceived as the higher risk move. Because if you fail, there are higher consequences. You've given the other team an advantage. And the point is that because the failure rate is pretty low, it's actually fine. But on the rare times when you do give the other team the advantage and then they score, the fear of that scenario completely makes their brain freeze up and stop focusing on the cold, hard numbers. And that kind of gets to the heart of it. That whether it's fear of something bad happening or whether it's the thrill of the prospect of winning $10 million in the lottery, it is super, super easy to make the brain override what the numbers are telling them. Even if you're a professional and you're at the very, very top of your field, it just doesn't matter. You still are dictated by basically superstition.
It's sort of like the Monty Hall thing in the sense that like it only made sense to me when I was thinking about it from Monty Hall's perspective as opposed to the player's perspective, because Monty Hall is, you know, he's like, oh shit, I have to open this door. And it's like when you're playing cards, you don't want to give the other person information because that's a strategic advantage. If you're a football fan, the easiest way to tell that it's statistically better to go for it is that every time the other team goes for it against your team, you're like, shit, you wish they hadn't. Put yourself in the other people's shoes. Yeah. The thing they don't want you to do is go for it. But because your side is kind of acting out of fear.
Right, because there's fear in the Monty Hall thing, too, because if there's 3 doors and I pick one based on no information other than one of these doors has a car, great. And then if he takes away one of those doors, it's like, well, now you could change your mind. I am so afraid that I change my mind to the wrong answer. And I'm not as afraid if I stick with my gut to begin with, you know? Because if I choose, all right, now I'm going to switch to door number two. Oh, no, you were right the first time. That's a thing where I can actually get mad at myself and blame myself forever.
Exactly. It's the fear of I changed my mind and then it turned out it was back there all along. And then, because here's what happens. A completely incorrect impulse, but one that pervades all of human society, will kick in. Everyone will look at you and said, oh man, you should have gone with the original answer. You should have trusted your gut. And that is not true. And Jack, you played in the NBA for 5 seasons.
Yeah, I had a little stint.
You know what all great basketball coaches know, and this is especially true for, I think, the coach of the Spurs, I think, is great about this, that whether or not a shot a player took was a good shot has nothing to do with whether or not it went in. That's luck. There's a measure of luck there. What you're looking for is, did they take the right shot? And if you're 6'10" power forward who is a 20% three-point shooter, if he took a three-pointer from half court and made it, that doesn't become a good shot because it went in. You still bench that guy and say, look, that's not the shot you take. I don't care that it went in. But what happens instead is most average people, most bad coaches, will slap that guy in the back and like laugh, like, ah, you know, you knew it was there or something. And no, he didn't. He was a moron for taking that shot. He just got lucky. And so they build the offense around saying, look, long term, as long as we keep doing the thing the statistics say works, even if we fail for 2 straight months, the odds will swing around. They will. The universe works that way.
One thing that the Spurs knew and that my dad, who's a basketball coach, figured out early on was that, first of all, threes are just, when you look at the percentage of threes that go in versus the number of points you're rewarded, threes are a great shot. And there's this spot in the corner of a basketball court that is, if you've ever seen an NBA basketball court, because of the shape of the court, they just kind of go flat in the corners because they just run out of court, essentially. So that means that the very corner of the basketball court is a few inches closer to the basket behind the three-point line than the rest of the court. That few inches makes it maybe 2 percentage points more likely to go in when an NBA player shoots it. And that is the most efficient shot in all of basketball. And good coaches like the Spurs coach would just kind of look at the court as a bunch of percentages, you know, like all the shots from the corner. That's the highest percentage point shot. That's the most efficient shot. And so they would just maximize the number of shots that they could get there. I want to go back to something you said about fear, because that also kind of works in reverse. One of the other strangest statistics that we've ever covered on the site is that going to the doctor, having a regular physical, as everybody is told to do, leads to a shorter life expectancy. That's sort of the opposite of what you'd expect. And the theory for why this is that you're sort of lured into a false sense of security. Your healthy fear is taken away from you. When you have a symptom, you're like, well, I've got this clean bill of health, so I don't have to go into the doctor. You know, you just are on this unnatural schedule. When you look at the statistics, basically healthcare in general, like getting medical care, is way more dangerous than not, which when you hear about, you know, older people being like, I'm not going to the doctors unless my leg falls off, you're like, oh, well, they're probably screwed. And, you know, you don't want to perform surgery on yourself, probably, but hospitals are statistically one of the most dangerous places to be in the world because of infection and because charts get mixed up and suddenly, you know, you're getting open heart surgery or something. There's this way that our fear leads us to kind of do things that are way more dangerous, but it's almost worth it to us to go to the hospital and get every last thing checked out or have that checkup, just because it may eventually kill us, but it makes us feel more comfortable and worry less throughout the year.
Right, and then it's not my fault if anything goes wrong, because I went into the place that's supposed to be clean with people who are supposed to be smarter than me. And then if anything goes wrong, it's, well, I did the best I could by climbing into this, as you describe it, Jack, den of poison full of drunk maniacs.
Yeah.
mad with power.
My doctor wife is going to love this episode. Anything that gives you the ability to kind of turn your brain off, I think, is behind a lot of the statistically, like, surprisingly dangerous things. Like, we think of, like, people working themselves to death, but actually, like, retiring early, or people who are retired have shorter lifespans than people who just, like, work right up to the very end, because they're, like, kind of engaged and they're constantly, like, thinking. They're never just, like, turning their brain off.
They're interacting with people. They're building a larger social circle. Like, a lot of people, you retire, they just sort of withdraw, but, you know, at work, you're forced to deal with people. You have to, and that's, we're social animals.
And the people at work are like, man, your foot is starting to smell like cheese. You should get that amputated, but not at the
hospital.
That's
exactly it, though. I mean, that's, you're joking, but that's exactly, when you're around people, there's all sorts of ways they help you, even if you hate them. Even if you go to work every day, like if you drag yourself to work every day dreading, you know, I've got this freaking podcast to record and I just hate these people, like that's still better than just quitting. And I do want to talk about sort of the opposite, because you started to mention it, but the whole thing with dangers that we inflate, the flip side of that is good luck that we mistake for something. And I want to get into the birthday problem, because this actually is harder for me to grasp than the Monty Hall problem. But it gets into the whole thing, like someone talked about Wyatt Earp became a famous cowboy because he had this long resume of famous gunfights he was in and had survived. And so the whole thing was like, this guy is the baddest badass in all the West because he's unkillable. When statistically, somebody was going to survive all those gunfights. It was inevitable. It could have been him, could have been somebody else. But once you've survived, you retroactively declare him invincible, when all that happened was the bullet that whizzed by his head instead of going into his eyeball. This is a minuscule millimeter off. There's who knows how many chances to die he actually had. But, you know, that's the thing, is that because he was the one who got filtered down, now we look at him and say, well, there must be something magical about him. He had that it factor, that survivability, that the NFL player who never gets injured, like, he's just got to be something about him. It's like, well, no, statistically, again, even if we just randomly generated the outcomes of these gunfights, somebody was going to survive 50 gunfights. It's just as somebody's going to win the lottery.
I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, but this is my theory on Hitler, because like every anecdote you hear about him and all available evidence is that he wasn't super bright, or, you know, he was somewhat charismatic in the sense that he paid a lot of attention to how he appeared to people. But it seems like he might have just been the statistically luckiest idiot in the history of the world. That is going to happen when you have billions and billions of people born into billions and billions of circumstances. One awful psychotic moron is going to just get crazy, super lucky, and like suddenly be on the brink of running the world. Let's talk about how the crazy thing I just said relates to the birthday problem.
If anybody wants to go find that episode, the title is Why Hitler Was Right. I think it was from May of this year. It's 3 hours long, but it gets into, we got a lot of letters about that one. But we actually, not to stay on Hitler for the rest of the discussion, but you can go into Hitler's life and find so many times when it could have gotten derailed, his whole thing. So many times when he could have gotten killed. So many assassination attempts he just lucked, just dumb luck, avoided. Just all these things, if World War One hadn't happened exactly the way it had, if his military career hadn't gone exactly the way it did, there are just all these things that fell into place. Where in a movie, like, you would have the mastermind character who somehow makes it all happen. And it's like, no, he was not a mastermind.
There's a British soldier who had him in his line of sights who was like, This one German in World War One, I'm going to let him go. He seems like a good guy. And like Hitler had a picture of that German soldier on his wall and was like, oh, this guy's really the best. He was just like kind of Forrest Gumping his way through history, it seems like, to the point that like one of his major undoings was, you know, D-Day. And one of the reasons D-Day was so successful was because Hitler slept in until like noon that day. People were like, well, we can't move all our troops to the defensive position because Hitler's not awake and he's super cranky when you wake him up.
That, like, was also completely dumb luck on America's part at the exact same time that it even worked for us. We were supposed
to
land the day before, but the weather was bad. And so we waited the next day, and Eisenhower was still told, you know, the weather's supposed to be bad. We should just delay. We were like, no, if we wait one more day, then the tide won't be right for us, so we'll have to wait even more days. I know there's a storm coming. Let's just fucking go. And the storm was just like, oh, this guy seems like he's got a plan, so we better just back off.
It was just like one piece of good luck after another until the very end for Hitler.
Okay, the birthday problem. If you went into school in first grade and say you got a classroom of 20 kids, if you sit down next to a kid and you're talking about something and the kid mentions, Saturday's my birthday, and you have this lightning bolt where you realize, holy crap, Saturday's my birthday too. What the hell are the odds? We must be destined to be friends, because what are the odds that in this one classroom, two of us are going to have the same birthday? And the answer is the odds are 50-50. If you have 23 people in a room, even though there are 365 days in a year, if you have 23 people, there's a 50-50 chance that two of them will have the same birthday.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me.
No,
I don't
wrong.
Believe you.
You're wrong. You're
yeah,
crazy
I think
person.
You're wrong about that. All right, end of podcast. Jason's making shit up now.
Just a rap song fades in. Just over that. There's no further explanation. This is a dumb pet theory that Jason has. Number 23.
Yeah, no, we're looking at the chart right now, and charts don't make sense to me.
This one is difficult because it takes algebra to explain it on paper. But the reason the flaw is you think, well, look, there's 365 days. There's about 20 of us in your 23. So even my dumb math, I can say that's only 1/15th of the days, right? There's 23 of us. We have 23 different birthdays. There's 365 days. So there's still only like a 1 in 15 chance that we have a match. And that's true if you're saying, what are the odds that someone else in this room shares my birthday? That's not what we're saying. We're saying, what are the odds that anyone in this room shares a birthday? Because among those 23 people, there are now 253 potential pairs. So your chances to have two or that are the same go up astronomically. And so they can chart it. If you've got only two people, the odds of sharing a birthday are only, whatever, 0.3%. If you've got four people, it goes up to like 3%, and it goes up and up and up because it goes up exponentially, because each time you're multiplying, it's not just whether or not any of these other three people share my birthday, it's whether or not any two of the four of us share a birthday, and it may not involve me at all. So that 1 in 15 chance keeps getting cut smaller and smaller. This is another case where if you are listening to this and it still sounds like sorcery, go out on the freaking internet and find any list of people. Sports rosters is one way you can do it, where it lists their birth date. And you'll find, yeah, about half the time. A few minutes before this call, I literally went and looked at the New York Yankees roster. So, like, on their roster, there's two, Brendan Ryan and Ramon Flores, both born March 26th. Went to the Red Sox roster, both Jonathan Herrera and Alex Wilson, both born on November 3rd. If you've got a group of 25 or so people or anything in that neighborhood, your odds, it's a coin toss. You can go through and look at them, and you'll find, yeah, half the time, two of them share a birthday. It happens in the real world. Find a list of faculty at a small school. Find a list of classmates in a class. You can literally just go out there and look if you don't believe it, and you'll see it. You'll see it play out right in front of your eyes.
Or you can choose not to look and still think Jason's crazy.
And just believe it.
Because I think what people are coming away with, it makes sense when you take yourself out of the equation, when you say it's not about how many people in this room share my birthday. It's just the idea that two people in this room share the same birthday. It's super hard to grasp when you're just thinking about it based on yourself, because I think, well, you put 23 people in a room. I've met way more than 23 people in my life. I'm not trying to brag. And I've never met anyone with my birthday before. So, Jason, it sounds like we both have pretty strong arguments here.
And the first thing Dan says to someone is his birthday, even before his name.
Well, because most of them haven't properly congratulated me or celebrated me, especially when we first meet. So I want to give them the opportunity to say either, happy birthday, sorry I missed your last birthday, can't wait for your next birthday.
Right.
One of those things.
But among the people, just the people you work with at Crack, no one shares your birthday, but you do know two people who share a birthday.
Yeah, I in fact know four people, yeah. Both of the Katies who are in all of our videos have the exact same birthday.
Most of our editors are born within 3 days of each other. It's insane.
True.
But that's, I think I've mentioned before, that's my hiring criteria. Yeah, it's almost like the Monty Hall thing in the sense that if you tell the Monty Hall story without saying, this is you, it's happening to you, and you're making this decision for yourself. If you're just telling it without a point of view. And the problem is that you're imagining it as yourself rather than just a random grouping of 23 people. That seems to be almost like the subjectivity of human experience is what screws us every time. The fact that you saw the person win the lottery, the fact that you're afraid for your own safety is what kind of blinds you to the statistical reality of things.
That right there is what's behind all of this. Because deep down, you still believe the universe revolves around you. The thing you believed as an infant in the crib, where that crib was the whole universe and everything kind of just served you, like these beings came in and gave you food or whatever. That was your first impression of the universe, was that it's this thing that hovers over your eyes and gives you things. It's like The Secret, that stupid-ass book where if you wish hard enough, the universe will like start giving you money. If you demand it, Oprah was pushing this for a while, this weird cult that started. Everyone instinctively thinks in those terms. This means something. If I'm betting on a sport and I successfully pick 6 straight games, there's meaning here. I'm hot. I'm locked in. I'm on a hot streak. You know, everything's falling my way. Because if it happened to somebody else, you would have no problem saying, wow, they just got lucky. Somebody was going to pick 6 in a row. That's statistically 100% that somebody in the world is going to pick 6 in a row. It had to be somebody. But for them, the fact that they are that somebody, it takes on a completely different meaning. It's like, no, this is me here, though. This is, I'm the star of this movie.
Yeah.
So this is a key plot point that I picked 6 games in a row. And the idea that, so now, next month, when you lose 6 in a row, it's like, why, God, why? Why have you taken my good fortune from me? It's like, no, you've just reverted to the mean. You know, you can do things to improve your odds. Obviously, you have a better chance of making a lot of money if you actually leave the house than if you just stay there. There's all sorts of things you can do to affect your own life. But it's almost all the wrong things. We mentioned in last week's podcast or the week before about that poll that showed that, you know, 50% of teenagers either wanted to be famous or expected to be famous. They had no grasp on what percentage of people, even in the YouTube era, what percentage of people actually successfully become famous. It's a ludicrous idea, but it's like, because I'm inside my own head, in every movie I've ever watched, that person is the chosen one, or they meet their soulmate, things fall together in just the right way. You just expect things to fall together for you. Like, you expect everything that happens to you to be part of your story, and it has this deeper meaning. And in many, many cases, no. It was just blind chance. You could have just as easily missed that thing as hit it.
The narrative of our lives kind of puts everything in the context that we need it to, including statistics. And that is the thing that my quote up top, I think, is trying to get at, that statistics are like assholes. The thing that with Moneyball wasn't just saying, hey, if you actually count the number of times people get on base, that's actually valuable. It was saying, no, this number is actually better than the one that makes inherent sense to you. It's not as clear cut as like, we're the star of our own movies, but if you look at the numbers, you can learn the truth. It's actually, we're the star of our own movies, and we will use the numbers to prove that we're right and that we're the hero of the movie. Whatever makes it easier to make sense of that reality.
Every sort of privileged person, like if you, for instance, were born in America and are a white male middle-class person, one reason why it's so easy to convince somebody in that category to become racist is just by simply showing them in this community where they have really high crime, they also have a lot of black people. So, you know, clearly the blacks are pre-programmed to be criminals, just like I thought. And the idea that if you had been born there with the exact same influences, the exact same circumstances, exact same schools, parenting, and everything else, that you also would be a criminal just doesn't compute. And if I show you stats upon stats upon stats, the difference when a kid moves out of that neighborhood, goes to a different environment, the difference when somebody moves into that environment, the difference back when those neighborhoods used to be poor Italians or poor whatever, that you would see the same result. You see the same result all around the world. There's certain things that these cycles that take effect, and you can boil it down to cold numbers. And it's like, you refuse to believe that the good things you have are not the result of a bunch of great choices you made.
Right.
Because, again, you're the hero of your own story. Like, I wrote a book that became a bestseller, so everything I have is due to my having written that book, right? And it's like, well, the statistically, if you, Jason, had been born, say, in Kenya and had, at age, you know, 4, had been sent to work in a diamond mine, probably statistically you don't wind up in the same. You probably don't have a podcast at age.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't arrive in that same spot.
Then you're just a diamond baron millionaire.
Right. But everybody, whether they say it out loud or not, secretly believes. I don't want to say everybody. Many, many privileged people, whether they say it or not, secretly believe that, well, if I had been born in the hood, my story would be like Will Smith's story in Pursuit of Happiness. I would have scraped and saved up my money and gone to school and burned stocks and da-da-da, and I would have lived in a bathroom until I had the money to get a job. It's like all of those forces that made those people poor, and the statistically have a very high probability of making someone poor, it wouldn't work on you. Somehow. I know that I was born into very favorable circumstances, but I'm sure I would have still wound up here. And we tell ourselves that story that even you see like a crime victim, there's instinct like they had to have done something. They had to have screwed up. So, because we want to believe that we're in control of all of it. And so, you know, if somebody dies in a car accident, somebody dies in a house fire, you have this knee-jerk response to like, well, were they drunk or did they set themselves on fire? Because the idea that we could just someday be a statistic in somebody else's newspaper is unthinkable. That stuff can't apply to us. We're in Star Wars, we're Han Solo surviving the asteroid belt, even though the odds are 30,000 to 1, as C-3PO says, because we're always the one person who defies the odds, because that's how it works in movies. We're the star of our own movie. We're not one of the people in the background who gets killed when 2012 destroys the Earth by whatever means that I didn't see that movie. But no, I'm going to be John Cusack. I'm going to be one of the five people to survive.
From our perspective, we're all Luke Skywalker. And from the perspective of statistics, we're one of the stormtroopers in the big giant wave of stormtroopers shooting badly and randomly getting picked out to get hit with a laser.
It's not even that. We're one of the random peasants on Alderaan who didn't even know anything was going on and the planet blew up. You didn't get like a warning, like that's who you're more likely to be. You're just working in an office on Alderaan and then you see this light in the sky and then vaporized.
Well, I'm a stormtrooper. You might be one of the peasants. Guys, and I think Dan is the Sarlacc pit.
Yeah, you guys are such downers. I just can't even stand it.
Was that a downer?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
No, but it's acknowledging that, like, everyone who is listening to this, if you have working ears and a computer and electricity and are in a position in your life that you're able to do things like this, listen to things on the internet, you are riding a crest of incredible good fortune. Because if you take all of the humans who have ever been born through all time, and no one knows the true answer because there's no definite cutoff at which point we're not considered humans anymore, but it's many billions of beings that have come and gone. You are in the upper tiny tip-top percentage, fraction of a percent in terms of what's available to you, how comfortable your life is, resources available to you. Living in the first world in 2014, you are at the golden tip of a golden era. You have the best of the best of all the humans. Keep in mind, you know, 95% of all the humans or 98% of the humans who ever lived in a world that didn't have anesthetic. When they went to the doctor to get a tooth pulled out or to get their liver cut open or to get their leg cut off, you just bit down on a belt and felt them cut into you. You know?
So it's not depressing, Dan.
Right, no, and I want to add to Jason's point, you're all very fortunate because you were smart and you worked hard and you made all of these things happen for yourself. Did I miss something?
Yeah, it's all you. Yeah, although maybe the future, maybe the billions and billions of people in the future, because we're all getting smarter. That's my hope, is that this is the dark ages of some more enlightened future that I will bring about by defeating the forces of evil.
The great
with
cleansing
podcasts
will begin soon. All it takes is the death of the unrighteous, and we all know who they are.
Hot chili peppers in the blistering sun, dust on my face and my cape. Me and Magdalene on the run. I think this time we shall escape.
All right, hope you enjoyed that. I think this subject can kind of seem depressing sometimes because it seems almost permanent, like we're sort of doomed to not understand the world around us and be constantly surprised by these objective, cold, scientific statistics that prove we're all idiots. I feel like scientists and economists and other people who work with numbers are always sort of agreeing with that central sentiment that the species is sort of doomed because of how unmathematical our brains are and we're really bad at viewing the future as a real thing. But I think that's actually a little short-sighted, which makes sense because academics can spend their entire careers on a single thesis about a single type of fecal bacteria or whatever, a single historical figure. But when you look at it in the broad scope of the point in human history that we exist at, it makes more sense, I think, that our outlook would be dominated by the flaky, bullshitty antenna that uses words, and that we'd underutilize the one that measures stuff, because words came first. They come first sort of in our daily lives. We use them first to kind of build out a worldview, and it's only later that we learn to kind of test things with the numbers. And when you do, those numbers are in the context of all the words, and those words tend to have a lot of inertia, like we talked about up top. And then the broad scope of history, people have been talking for almost as long as they've been people. That's kind of one of the things that supposedly defines us as humans. And we've only been fact-checking the stuff we've been saying with statistics for probably like a few thousand years. I don't know. When was math invented? Look it up. I feel like science and sort of what we're doing now is sort of the process of backing out of history one big misconception at a time. You know, history has a pretty big head start, so let's give ourselves a couple thousand years to figure some shit out. Give it a couple generations even. You know, we've got these smartphones. We're getting better at sort of objectively monitoring ourselves. I hear one day our smartphones will even be able to talk to our watches. And when that happens, I mean, there's no telling what we can do. All right, on to footnotes. We open with the song My Mathematical Mind by Spoon, which is a great band I loved in my 20s, who I recently saw at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. That's a thing that the rest of the country might not realize happens out here, and nobody acts like it's a weird thing that people are just getting drunk and smoking pot and rocking out on top of people's dead grandparents. But it was a great show. Those people's relatives needn't worry. They died for a good cause, to provide an interesting bit of atmosphere to the Spoon show I went to. But they were promoting their new album, which I like a lot. It's called They Want My Soul, I believe. This song is off one of the elder albums, Gimme Fiction. But I found that a lot of people I told I was going to the Spoon show didn't know what those words meant in a sentence together. So I figured I'd share the band with you in case you were like my friends and didn't know who Spoon was. We listened to two songs from Bob Dylan's album Desire. First, we listened to a song called Isis. Now, I could lie and tell you that it's a thematic fit, like My Mathematical Mind, the Spoon song, which, by the way, great thematic fit, Jack. But I'm pretty sure I've only had this album, Desire, running on a loop in my head for the past few weeks, because every time I hear the word ISIS in the news, this song starts playing. The Bob Dylan voice in my head starts singing about marrying ISIS on the 5th day of May, and then eventually getting brainwashed into digging for some treasure at the foot of some temple. What the hell is Bob Dylan ever talking about, you guys? And we're going to ride out on a second song from that album called Romance in Durango, which might be my favorite Bob Dylan song. And another possible reason, I guess, maybe, that you're listening to two of my favorite Bob Dylan songs off that record is that I moved this week. And that is one of the few albums that I actually have on vinyl from my embarrassing days as a hipster. So, yeah, hope you enjoyed those songs. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Before we leave you, I do want to tell people of Nashville, we are going to be doing a live podcast at Zany's in Nashville, Tennessee on 8th Avenue, Wednesday, the 24th of September. So it's coming up. Starts at 7:30, doors open at 6 p.m. That's a lot of wiggle room there. So there's going to be a stand-up comedy part, and then there's going to be a live podcast with Jason, Dan, Swaim. Tickets are $10. It's 18 and over, and I think there's going to be a two-drink minimum. But yeah, you get two great shows, and one of them will be the live version of this with a slightly sweatier version of me. Get to see what I look like. Hopefully it's not too jarring. It's always so weird for me whenever I see the hosts of my favorite podcasts. I never have them even close to being what I thought they'd look like. But anyways, that's coming up. If you live in or around Nashville, the state of Tennessee, come out and see us. We'd love to meet you, sign your favorite podcast. And we're off next week, back the week after that with more podcast. Talk to you then.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio. Boom.com. The wolf dead.